My guest today is novelist and story writer Robert Coover, perhaps the funniest and most inventive of that manically inventive crew of American postmodernists, which flourished as a kind of new wave in the 1960s and 70s. Other names that come to mind are Thomas Pynchon, Donald Barthelme, John Barth, and William Gaddis. Since 1966, Coover has published 8 novels and 3 story collections, including such contemporary classics as The Public Burning, Prick Songs and Descants, The Universal Baseball Association, J. Henry Waugh Prop, and Spanking the Maid. In volume after volume, he has demonstrated an amazing ability to take the dross of nowness, the babbitry of modern middle America, and by manipulating, vivisecting, and projecting it through an endless variety of rhetorical tropes, games, and playful tangents, turning it into a semblance of meaning and depth. Now, Simon & Schuster has just published Robert Coover's newest novel, John's Wife. John's Wife puts a small town in middle America under a microscope, dancing from character to character, creating a web of intersecting points of view, personal histories, and perspectives. At the center of the web, the object of everyone's desire is, yes, John's wife, a beautiful but somewhat vague creature who never appears as a point of view character and who actually begins to disappear as the novel wears on. John is a successful contractor, a mall builder, fraternity brother, and inveterate womanizer. Most of the characters in the book are hangers-on, caught in a kind of economic or sexual fealty to John. Had Coover set out simply to write a book about how class, money, and sex work in a small town, John's wife would have filled the bill. When the novel is done, we know this town, its history, geography, planning, and politics through and through. But this is only a thread in Coover's tapestry. As the novel cavorts via multiple murders, seductions, rapes, and infidelities consummated on golf greens, toward its outrageously fiery Rabelaisian climax, a giant King Kong-like woman trapped in a burning forest by a sheriff's posse, Coover seems to be saying something larger, metaphysical, if you will, about the nature of meaning, about the carnival of human behavior, about art, about everything, in short, about which we are not supposed to be able to speak in this highly theoretical day and age. And so, one is forced to write a novel. Robert Coover, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, after I read this, the first thing I thought was you must have had a heck of a lot of tack board space around your study to keep track of all these characters.
Well, in the old days that was certainly true, and still to some extent, but now most of this is tacked up on the computer screen.
Oh, right, of course. Because I've stopped counting after about 20 points of view that you would cycle through in this book. Do you have some sense of how many? You probably know specifically exactly how many there are.
No, numbers, census count. I have probably about, I'd say about 30 to 40 characters who get point of view opportunities, although there are a few who don't that are, in fact, dead before the novel begins and who nevertheless play major roles in the book. So it was an effort to be kind of representative, at least of this class of people in such a prairie town.
And it is a prairie town. Now, you yourself started out in Iowa, and this has the feel of a kind of basically a white middle class prairie town. The basis of the book is a kind of ultra realism, a very kind of minute dissection of the way people live, the way they owe loyalty in a town of this sort. And there's an extensive dissection of that material. And that must interest you at some level.
Well, my first book, you know, was set in a similar town, although it was a coal mining community, but it was had the same prairie qualities, and that's the origin of the Brunists. And I suppose inevitably, especially the further away one gets from those early spaces, the more they return to haunt one. So I had long had a kind of ambition to do a sort of Arabian Nights type adventure story set in such a space and give it that kind of sort of mythic quality. And part of that it has to do with the feeling of isolation you have on the prairie, that you can have towns that seem to be lines or something. And I think that was part of the long... It wasn't the reason I wrote the book, but it had been sitting in the back of my mind wanting to do this for some time.
Now, the realism, the reality of this town begins to unravel, though, in the text fairly quickly. About page 40, I noticed it start to fray into a kind of, first of all, into a kind of sexual frankness and a kind of polymorphous perversity. That's one thing that you do a lot. In your other books, the varieties and modes of sexual congress are very interesting. They become almost sort of rhetorical. It's like putting sentences together. You just put people together. Is that what you're thinking about?
All right. Yes, some are adjectives and some are nouns. You know.
It becomes less sexual and more like parsing a sentence. Does it feel like that to you when you're writing? I mean, one sense, there's a kind of a dividing line between a kind of playfulness, which is very rhetorical and very literary, and this ultra-realistic bent that you have.
Well, I suppose the I don't know about the sexuality and the polymorphous perversity, etc.
It's there.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know how that works in grammatical terms or even thought structures. But it's certainly true that this book is partly dedicated to Ovid, who shared the ancient vision of desire being at the heart of the universe, the driving force of the universe, and that this element, this eros, is an irrational force that is sort of only tapped into by humans, not something that belongs to them exclusively. And this feeling, probably this conviction that's Ovid's, and which I certainly in this work anyway am sharing, force character, that aspect of human life, to the center. And it, because it's thought of in those terms, it becomes something more to I suppose to think about than to do. In other words, this is not something that's going to send people running to their bedrooms. It's going to alarm them for the most part, I think. But it's more in the line, I hope anyway, of the Ovidian view of amores.
Now the realism again breaks down not just on the sexual lines, but on the lines of verisimilitude itself. At a certain point, some of the plot lines take on a kind of mythic or magical or fantastical quality. Ghosts appear to people. John's wife, the very sort of central character, the central object of desire, actually disappears in certain situations. And then you have this character, Pauline, who becomes a kind of monster. That very quickly kind of balloons up in size to something like King Kong, right? And this again is a kind of way of ironizing or undercutting the kind of realism.
Or reinforcing it. I learned my realism from Kafka many years ago, and once I understood him as the ideal realist, it's made possible the rest of everything I've done, I think. And there's, I hope, Pauline's condition is, in effect, brought into the real world, you might say. So it's not... of course, it is a story being told, and it's in that sense that the story is part of the real world. And in that story, these things not only can happen, but must happen.
It's a very Rabelaisian move, that particular plot move.
Well, I've been accused of that before. And
is that an accusation?
I appreciate the accusation. I have an appetite, I suppose, for excess or something that emerges in these texts. And here, I think it's more in my sense of how things work, I find a metaphor that seems to be important to me, and it's usually a cluster of ideas, not a single one. And my task is to be kind of intransigently loyal to it. And that intransigence drives me into these gargantuan moments. If it exists in the flower, then you have to let it bloom.